Hi, and welcome to the Well-Read Podcast, a bi-weekly discussion on books and reading. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Anne.
And we are librarians with the Beaufort County Library in South Carolina. This week, we're going to be talking about some of our favorite book club picks and our ideas on how to run a good book club. And I know you have a mystery book club at the library, right?
Yes.
And what do you think makes a good book club pick?
I think it has to be something that has some meat to it. So there has to be something discussable. I personally don't like things that are things that can be too controversial, because then people get all riled up and you don't really want a negative experience of the book club. So I don't like things that have kind of political overtones or things like that. But there definitely needs to be enough to grab onto and have opinions. Mm-hmm. So I don't like things that are too fluffy.
Right.
There's lots of books I would love to do at my book club that are big mysteries, but they just are not deep enough.
There's not enough there to talk about.
Right.
Yeah. I always think that it's good if you could have a book that has diverse opinions about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book that everybody loves, even though that seems like the kind of book that you would want to pick, because then, you know, everybody's happy to have read it.
Right.
But typically in my book clubs does not lead to a very good discussion because people don't have much to say about
it.
I find that people are better at talking about why they don't like something, or the talking about issues or characters and stuff that there's some complexity to,
mm-hmm.
rather than just, oh, I really loved that book, it was so great.
Because
then they have a harder time parsing it out. Or it's good if you have some people that really liked it and some people that didn't like it, because then they just can discuss what about it they liked, what about it they didn't, and what the differences were there.
Right. Yeah. I've had books where everyone loved the book unanimously,
yes.
and we're like, well, okay, we don't have
we
anything
all agree.
To say
right.
about this. So there has to be more to pull apart.
Right.
So something that has good characters, or characters that make interesting decisions.
Yes.
I like books that maybe have some ambiguity in them.
Yes.
And so you can sort of talk about what you think the author was getting at in the ending, or what was happening in the book. Had some really, I think I talked about The Little Stranger a few weeks ago,
yeah.
and we had a great discussion about that, because there were so many things that were potential plot twists, mm-hmm. and things that we disagreed on what they meant. And it was really fun to talk about that.
We did Gone Girl in my book club, and that's a similar, there's some characters' actions that there's a lot to talk about, as well as the story. And then the ending, I won't spoil anything, but the ending of that, there's a lot to talk about
right.
with the ending. So
right.
I think one of the criticisms I've heard, I know, and when we're selecting books in my book club, is people feel like they're too heavy,
mm-hmm.
all the books, or too depressing often. Lots of times I think book club books are like about World War II or women in peril in some way, or like with hard lives, I should say, not in peril. And so it can be difficult, I think, to find a book that isn't so depressing or heavy, but yet still has enough to talk about.
Right.
I think that's always, I try to mix some of those into the voting when we select books.
Yeah.
And it could be difficult to find that. We've done a few that are a little bit lighter, but still have things to discuss. And I always feel like I've hit a gold mine when I
totally.
Find one of those, because it can be difficult to find something that has enough to discuss and isn't,
mm-hmm.
you know, on topics that can be depressing.
Right. Yeah. And also people tend to read the same books for book club picks. And
right.
so then you have things that you're, you don't want to read the same book that everyone else has read all over, and just be repeating yourself. So there's lots of things to come to think about.
And what resources do you use when to come up with the questions for your book club?
There's a couple that I use really often. There's one called readinggroupguides.com, mm-hmm. and they have really good discussion questions, and they have tips on how to run a book club. They've got general questions that are specific to the genre in case there isn't book-specific questions. And I really like that one. And then another is called litlovers.com, and that has kind of the same
right.
stuff behind it. So, I also, if I'm having trouble, will sometimes just Google the book
right.
and find a lot of people that are talking about it, and that will help me sort of develop some questions too.
Yeah, I also use Novelist, mm-hmm. which is a reader's advisory resource
right.
that a lot of libraries have subscriptions to. And they don't do this for every book in my book club, but they have reading or book discussion guides for
mm-hmm.
some books, a lot of books. And they're typically not the same questions that the publisher has produced.
Oh, cool.
And they also provide answers. And there's a little disclaimer that, you know, these answers are just basically one person's opinion
yeah.
and not a correct answer. But it's really helpful in just thinking through the book and thinking through preparing to discuss the book, mm-hmm. even if I don't use those questions, I always like reading them and reading what the responses are just to give a more full picture of how to discuss the book and potentially what some people are going to be picking up as themes from the book or what they want to talk about in the book.
Yeah, that's a good
idea. That's another one. So that's one that does take a subscription to. Lit Lovers mm-hmm. and Reading Group Guides are just free, but Novelist, it does take a subscription through your library.
Yeah. Sometimes you'll find questions. I find that the questions that are at the back of the book are sort of fact-based, and mm-hmm. I always think this isn't a quiz on
the book. Well, this
discussion
isn't a class,
something where you're trying to say, who was the person that did this action in the book? And whenever I go to a book club where that's the question type, I don't want to be there. So I don't really enjoy the back of the book questions very much. I get excited when I see them because I think, oh, they'll do my job for me. And then I realize, no, I can't do this.
All right. So I think maybe if we start recommending the books that we have mm-hmm. and just as we talk about them, we'll probably throw in a few more hints about how to run a book club.
Yeah. So my first book is called Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner. And this won the Pulitzer Prize in 1972. So it's definitely a classic book. And it's framed by the story of Lyman Ward, who is a retired historian, and he's been confined to a wheelchair. He has a bone disease. I can't remember for sure. And he's also recovering from a divorce, so he's basically become this ill-tempered recluse. And he spends his time writing the story of his grandparents, who are named Oliver and Susan Ward, and they were settlers in the western United States in the 1870s. So the book kind of starts out with Lyman's story, and he interjects his narrative into the story of his grandparents, but it flips back and forth between the two. And so Oliver and Susan had met on the East Coast and married there, and then traveled west for Oliver's work. And he is an engineer and has been well educated and works in mining and irrigation and land development and those kinds of things. And he's very optimistic and very inspired by the West and sort of the lifestyle there. And Susan is from New York, and she's very cultured and very artistic and has this great writing talent. And so life in the West is not anything that she's used to. And she feels really repressed by the culture and the expectations that are on her to be a housewife and to be kind of this homemaker to her husband who has all the glory. So if you know anything about the West, that you know that mining towns rise and fall pretty quickly and that it's not really a secure form of business. So the couple moves from place to place as Oliver is working, and he'll have some great success in one location, and then the mine will fail and he'll have to move someplace else. So they have all this failure, or what Susan perceives as failure, and her unhappiness sort of increases exponentially as each move goes on. So the book is really about marriage and what people are willing to sacrifice for it and what happens when they won't sacrifice for it. And there's this constant tension that you're reading about, and I'm not married, but I have heard that this is very applicable to marriage. And this tension is what pushes the book forward. So there's, I think, a lot to talk about, especially in terms of what choices the characters make, because they all make really specific choices that lead to later issues in the book. Sometimes I can feel like books of this type, where it's covering many years of someone's story, that they can sort of lack a central conflict. And this one has one. So I think that that's something else that sort of moves the plot forward nicely. And the writing is just amazing. I think that this is a contender for the great American novel. I think it's just such a gorgeous book. And I'm from the West, and I sort of have never been that into my Western roots, but this totally made me get it and made me see sort of the romance and the what drew people there for so many years and still draws people there, I guess. I think it's a really good read-alike for something like East of Eden. There's sort of that, obviously the Western setting, but also the marriage that isn't quite right. It really reminds me of that. So there's so much to talk about in this book. You can talk about the choices that each character makes. You can talk about the setting as a character in itself, the role of women during this time period and what was expected of them. There's just, you could go on and on and on about this book. So I love it. It's one of my favorites. It's called Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner.
I've never read him, but he's one, Crossing to Safety and mm-hmm. Angle of Repose are both books that I continuously see as books recommended for book clubs.
Yeah, and considered like in the 100 best American books ever. Yeah, right. he's kind of not a household name, but super well respected too. So
he's one I have to get to.
Yeah, you'd like him, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I like East of Eden. I like Steinbeck. Yeah. All right, so my first one is The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert, and she is best known for the book Eat, Pray, Love, which is her memoir about going around the world for, a year or something like
Sometime.
That. Sometime. Finding herself. And this is her first novel in 12 years. She actually started as a novelist and then sort of took a detour into memoir writing. Now she's back and she wrote this, and this came out a year or two ago. And it is about a woman named Alma Whitaker, and she is born in 1800 to a very wealthy Philadelphia family. Her father is sort of a self-made man. He's from England or Ireland, I think, and was very poor and really grew to a very prosperous position, came over to the United States. And she is born as a very plain child. She's very smart, but she's very plain, and that's kind of how she's known, as being not very pretty. And she reads everything she can find. She learns Latin and Greek, and she has aspirations to really do something with her life. But due to being a woman, her prospects are really limited. And given that she's not very pretty, she sort of resigns herself to being a spinster. But she has a very keen interest in botany, and which is one of the few sciences at the time that women were allowed actually into like the inner circle. Particularly mosses. She's interested in mosses.
Oh, cool.
So she studies moss. And she thinks that that will be her life. She's actually writing a thesis, basically, that is along a parallel path as Darwin's thesis about like the origin of species. There's some other guy. I'm not a science person, but there's some other guy like at the same time. Also, real people writing about this. She's a made-up character.
Our science listeners will be screaming.
I know. Don't cringe. I could find it on the internet if I needed to. anyway, so she's displayed as a very intelligent person, and if she had been born a man, she would have had an entirely different path in her life because there's a lot of possibility for her, but because she's a woman, she's restricted. So she thinks she's never going to meet anybody, never going to find a husband. And then she meets a man named Ambrose Pike later in her life, and they have a very strong connection. He is also interested in the sciences, and they can talk for hours at a time. And she really feels like, oh, she's finally found something that's going to make her life complete, because she has the intellect part figured out of her life, but she doesn't have the emotional part figured out. And so she's ready to form a relationship, a long-term lasting marriage with him. And he has some different ideas about what their future will be. And I don't want to say more than that, but so she is disappointed at various points in her life because of these things. And she decides that she's just going to not care about what society thinks and kind of shrug off the conventions that are placed on women, and goes to Tahiti to pursue her scientific research and also other places around the world. So she sort of forges her own path. And I've talked about these kind of characters before. Mm-hmm. These are some of my favorite books are about women in a time when there's a very particular path that they were sort of meant to take, and the women who decide to forego that and do something totally different. She's a very strong woman. She makes some questionable decisions, I would say. So there's a lot to talk about in a book club because you feel like they're real characters. I know when my book club discussed this, we were literally talking to them about these people like they were real people that we knew, which I think is a really good sign of a book because you are so invested in the story and the characters that you can talk about these decisions they make as if you're really caring about the person, and then you realize, wait, these are made up people.
Right.
And again, there's the science aspect, there's history, the history of women, the history of science, there are expectations about women and about marriage. So there's a lot to talk about in here in a book club. And my book club really enjoyed it. And I think that people went into it, there were some people that didn't enjoy Eat, Pray, Love very much or had very specific opinions about Eat, Pray, Love and were pleasantly surprised at how different this was. I mean, it was almost hard to believe it was the same person who wrote both of them because this is kind of a very intricately plotted story. It's almost like an 18th century novel, I would say, or like a 19th century British novel, which is one of my favorites. Like this long, sort of sprawling, very intricate storytelling with lots of characters that you get to know very well. And so that was The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert. And I highly recommend it for something that maybe I think flew under the radar a little bit. It was pretty popular, but I think that there are still a lot of people that haven't heard of it, and it would make a really good book club pick and something a little different from the usual.
Yeah, I've heard really, really good things about it. My next book is The Beekeeper's Apprentice by Laurie R. King. And like you said, I run a mystery book club, so a lot of the things I choose as book club picks are mysteries. And I was once told by someone that mysteries don't make good book club picks because there's just not a lot to talk about. And I totally disagree. I think that there are a lot of really great complex mysteries out there that can lead to great discussions. And this is one that my book club really enjoyed and had a really good discussion about. So this is the first in a series. It's the Mary Russell series. And I think it's up to 13 or 14 books now. It's been going on for years and years, and she doesn't put one out every year. But she writes a lot of them, and the main idea behind the series is that it imagines Sherlock Holmes in his retirement years. So we're introduced to Mary Russell, who is a teenaged orphan, and she's living unhappily with her aunt in England, and she has a chance encounter with Sherlock Holmes, who's retired and raising honeybees in the country. So so it's kind of this quaint meeting between them. And almost immediately, Holmes recognizes that Mary has this brilliance that he understands, and he knows that her mind sort of works the same way that his does. So they start up a friendship, and there's obviously a huge age difference. And so they just have this nice friendship, and then it sort of becomes where he's taking her on as his apprentice, and he's actually training her. So she learns things like how to disguise herself, which is a big part of the Holmes stories, and how to fight people, and how to develop her talents of observation. And she really becomes this true partner to Sherlock Holmes as the book goes on. It starts out, the book covers all these kind of short cases that they solve together, and it covers several years. And throughout the book, it's I think they meet in, I want to say 1910 or something like that. And then, so it covers the years of World War One, and Mary goes to Oxford during that time. And so she becomes a young adult through the story. But as the novel goes on and you see these individual cases, you start to see, and Holmes and Russell start to see that there's a connection between these cases and that there's something bigger that's sort of propelling those forward. And so that ends up building to a really great conclusion instead of having just kind of little vignettes that go on and then bigger things happen in the rest of the books. So like I said, we did this in our book club and we had a really great discussion. There are lots of things you can talk about in terms of gender and the changes for women during this period of World War One, and things that suddenly became available to women that had not been career choices before those years. And I think it's also really fun. This is kind of the biggest thing that people talked about, was what choices that Laurie R. King makes as an author when there's already this very well-established Holmes canon. And can someone come in and add to that? And there's a lot of people that say no.
Really?
They can't. That's not fair. And it's not the same thing. And there were very, very strong opinions about this book, which I thought was really interesting, because I thought, oh yeah, it's great. It's a fun Sherlock Holmes story, but people felt very tied to that character and had really emotional feelings about it. And I'm not a huge fan of the Holmes stories personally. And so I actually really liked this as this other alternate way of looking at it. And I think that the author had said when I read an interview with her where she just imagined what Holmes would be as a woman, and this is what she came up with. And so so there are opinions about that too. And it just was a really fun discussion. I think that anything that takes sort of a well-known story or a well-known, even fairy tales are books like that, that sort of take something that's established and known in our culture and turns it on its head can make for really, really good discussions.
Yeah, I think so too. There's so much fodder for discussion from the premise. You don't even have to get to the story and you already have opinions, which is good.
Exactly.
Opinions are good in a book.
Yes.
My next one is Shadow Divers by Robert Kersen. And this is a nonfiction book that was selected in my book club several years ago. It's actually an older, relatively older book. It's from, I think, the 90s. It was written or maybe early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s. So as far as book club books go, often I think that it's more current, contemporary. Yeah. But this was one that was suggested. And it's, like I said, nonfiction, which I've mentioned before, I don't typically read that much nonfiction. And it's often my book club that exposes me to nonfiction books, because otherwise I don't know that I would ever get around to picking them up. But this one was fascinating. It is about two deep wreck divers who in 1991 were diving on a wreck and found a German U-boat from World War II off the coast of New Jersey. And there were no identifying marks on the boat or on any of the artifacts on the boat that they brought to the surface to examine. And so it was a big question about what this boat actually was, because there was no record from World War II of a U-boat being in that area at any point. So this mystery really captured the attention of these wreck divers, and they spent basically the next 6 years devoting their lives to trying to track where this U-boat came from and its history, what role it played in World War II. And it really became all-consuming to them. Part of the story is about their personal lives and what happens in their personal lives based on how obsessed they become with trying to find out details about this boat. And part of the issue is that as deep sea divers, they can only stay down a very limited amount of time before they have to come back up. And so they don't have very much time exploring the boat. Mm-hmm. It's in like 15-minute bursts that they have to get down there and try to find things and then come back to the surface because, you know, I don't know if you've ever been scuba diving, but I'm sure you've heard. So I'm sure you have to, as if you're based on how deep you go, when you come back up, you can't just go right back to the top because you get the bend. So you have to like, I don't know what it's called. And I'm actually scuba certified, but it was a long time ago. It's like you depressurize yourself basically as you go up. I don't know if that's the right term for it. Right. So you have to stop at certain depths to, or else too much nitrogen builds up in your bloodstream. Anyway, so because of that, they can't spend hours below the surface exploring this boat. And it's very expensive and they have to get funding to try to do it. And that's part of what happens in their personal lives that causes problems because they're spending money and time doing these. I found it completely gripping. Like I felt like it was one of those books that could have been fiction, which to me is a compliment. Yeah. I don't mean to disparage nonfiction or fiction by saying that, but there's the mystery of the boat. Mm-hmm. So you're curious about the origins of the boat. So there's some World War II history in there, which is very interesting as they trace the origins of it. There's the personal story of these men who, what they went through to try to do this. And then there's also the diving, which is really fascinating. So you're learning things about diving that you never would have thought of. If you're claustrophobic at all, which I'm a little bit claustrophobic, the images that they put in your head just made me so uncomfortable at times, because there are these tight little spaces that they have to swim through and it's dark and they only have the light with them that they're carrying to try to explore. So it's all darkness except for like a spotlight.
Oh my gosh.
And it's just, it's so atmospheric to read it. I just loved it. I just really couldn't put it down. And I thought it was such an interesting book to talk about in our book club because it's a true story. There's a lot of information that people didn't know. People had never realized that this U-boat even existed. Yeah. And I have some people in my book club who are from the Northeast. And so it was all news to them that this would even been there. And I just thought it was fascinating. And that's Shadow Divers by Robert Kirson.
Oh my gosh, I want to go get it right now.
So good. It really is so good.
My jaw has been dropping steadily as we've been talking about this.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
What's your next one?
So my third book is called Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass by Meg Medina. And this is a YA book, as you might imagine. And I have some other book clubs. Actually, I think all of my other book clubs are YA-based book clubs for adults. But I don't want anyone to think that it's fluffy or light or that there isn't enough to talk about. I think it's a really great topic, especially for adults. So the book is about a girl who's named Pitty Sanchez, and she lives in New York and she's just started a new school after moving to a new neighborhood with her mom. And she's told almost immediately when she gets there that a girl named Yaki Delgado wants to beat her up. And she has no idea why. She just somehow has gotten on the wrong side of her. So she does know that she stands out at school. So she's Latina and and the rest of the school is Latino, but she doesn't fit in with the culture there. It's kind of a rougher neighborhood than what she had come from, and she gets really good grades, and she's just seen as not wanting to be part of the social order there, and maybe seen as a little aloof because of her grades and that she does so well in school. So Yaki isn't an idle threat. This is a legitimate threat, and that she really wants to hurt Pity. So this is kind of icing on an already terrible situation for Pity. She's just left her best friend, who doesn't really seem to be that interested in maintaining a friendship, even though they still live relatively closely to each other. She is expected to work with her mom at a hair salon to help support the family, but she has to maintain her grades too. She is also finding out about her dad for the first time, and she's never met him and has no idea who he is. And she also has a crush, so all of these major things plus she likes a boy. So there's all these things that are sort of piling on top of each other. And the last thing that she needs is to be afraid of her safety when she goes to school. And so there's all these different things that are coming up, but the book doesn't get bogged down in them. It's really well paced and really good at bringing everything in a really realistic way. And Pity is just such a wonderful character. She's very likable and very relatable. I think that any teenage girl can find things that would appeal to them about Pity, and any woman who was once a teenage girl, or any man I think that was a teenager, would be able to see things that they dealt with in high school and can relate to really easily. I think that the most compelling part of this book is, and the thing that my book club talked about the most, is the horrors of modern bullying, and how when we were kids, you got beat up and stuff and got made fun of. I mean, some of us, but social media has added this whole new element to it that we just didn't experience. And I think that you hear about these things in the news, and you hear about how people get Facebook shamed and things like that. But to see the way it plays out in this book, and it's a really horrifying experience for Pity and for the reader. I think it was really, really hard to read, and I had a really hard, strong emotional reaction to what happens to her. That's just something that I hadn't really considered that much. And so to talk about it with other adults, and I have friends who have kids, and they talk about how terrified they are to raise their kids in this environment. And there's just so much that is new to think about. So we had a really great discussion about that. We talked about the cultural pressure to talk and act and look a certain way when that's just not you. We talked about dealing with changing friendships, mother-daughter relationships, how other people can bring you down when you aren't doing anything wrong. So these are all things that I think adults can relate to, even if they didn't deal with them as kids. They're still things that we deal with as adults today. So I did this I started a book club once that was for adults that like to read young adult literature, and we ended up not doing it for very long, but I read this book for that club too, and I had one person show up, and we still had an hour-long discussion, just the two of us, about this book. So if that isn't a stamp of how much there's to talk about, then I don't know what is.
Yes, that sounds. I've heard of her before. I don't think I've ever read her, but that sounds like a great book for anybody to read. Yeah, just in a book club.
Yeah, I know it's won some awards. I can't remember what they are offhand right now, but it's really, really a great book.
Good. All right, my last one is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, and I'm going to warn you right away that the description I'm going to give this book is not going to do it any justice, because it's one of those books that has multiple storylines and like jumps around in time a little bit, mm-hmm. and all the storylines are connected. So to try to describe all the storylines would take our entire podcast, so I'm not going to do that. So I will say that the book opens at a performance of King Lear, basically in present day. And the actor playing Lear collapses during the performance and dies of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And there's a young actress who's in the play named Kristen, who watches this all unfold kind of in horror as it's happening. And then there's a man in the audience who is a paparazzo, I guess.
Right.
Photographer. And he jumps up and tries to save the man's life. So those three characters are who you keep in your mind as the story goes forward. Because later that same night, a flu pandemic starts spreading, which ultimately wipes out 99.9% of the Earth's population. So the book then jumps to about 20 years later, and Kristen, the young girl who was watching this man die on stage, is in a traveling troupe, theater troupe, who perform Shakespeare plays in between the settlements that have sprung up since this flu pandemic hit. So she's sort of kind of the main character. Like, she sort of holds it all together. But then there are all these other threads of the people in her theater troupe. And then the settlement, one of the settlements they go to has this prophet who has all these followers and is a little bit violent or violent. And so he has a connection to the whole King Lear scene with the man dying. And then there's a place that they're trying to get where it's an abandoned airport terminal, where a settlement has sprung up there and they're trying to get there. And there's a connection there to the events that happened that night. So, like I said, it's all connected. And then you're also flashes back to the man who played King Lear, his life, because of these, it's like a 6 degrees of separation thing of how all these people are connected. And so you see his life prior to the night when he died. So you can get a sense of who different people are and how they're connected to each other. So, like I said, not a very good description. This is one you're going to have to try to trust me.
Still sounds really good.
Yeah, that it's worth reading. It's sort of, I know people have gotten a little bit burnt out on the post-apocalyptic storylines, and especially in teen books, there have been a lot of those. But this is one to make an exception for. I think it's more of a literary book. Her writing is fabulous. Her descriptions are really good, and just her writing style I really enjoyed. It's really just a riveting story. It moves along quickly. I didn't find it confusing at all, that it was sort of like a mystery unfolding as it went along, because you know people are connected. You're not sure how. And so you try to figure it out, which I just love that. Yeah. That's like catnip to me. I love those kinds of books. It's really moving in a way. It's interesting. I think part of, we have not discussed this in my book club, but I think it would make a good book club pick, because there are lots to talk about connections between people and what would happen if society kind of broke apart like that, and how you would form new connections and what humanity, how it would exist in that sort of situation, that scenario. And I liked that she skipped ahead by that amount of time, because it's not dealing with the immediate aftermath. It's dealing with people who, you know, Kristen was relatively young child. I think she was like 7 or 8. So some of her memories from the time when the world existed as we knew it are very flimsy. She doesn't really have a strong grasp, but she remembers little bits of things. And so a lot of what she knows is just the existence that she's known since the pandemic. So there's just a lot to talk about. Like, what would you do in that situation? How do you think you would survive? Just a lot to talk about. And then a lot to talk about the actual characters and the choices they make. So I thought it was great. It's called Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. And like your book, I think this won some awards. I know it was considered one of the best books of the year it came out. It came out, I think, in 2014.
Yeah.
I think. And I highly recommend this for a book club, but really for anybody. Mm-hmm. I think it was just an excellent book. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with what we're reading this week. So, Anne, what are you reading this week?
I'm reading a book called Slate House by David Mitchell. And this is maybe still Halloween themed, but it's always Halloween in my heart. So that's just
it's still fall, still a little spooky. It's getting dark early now.
And I started this before Halloween, so I just have not finished it yet. So this is David Mitchell wrote Cloud Atlas and recently The Bone Clocks. And so he's famous for that. This is a brand new book that it came out last week of October. And it's made up of 5 linked short stories, and they each take place on the last Saturday of October, but 9 years apart. So you jump forward in time between each story. And the first one, I'll just tell you about the first one, and then I'm not going to tell you about each story because, A, I haven't finished it, and B, that would ruin it. So it starts in 1979, and it's the first story focuses on a boy named Nathan who you figure out is autistic. It's not said specifically that he's autistic, but that's what I gathered from it. And his mother has been invited to Slate House as a pianist, and they're told in the invite to go to Slate Alley and then And it's a narrow and dark little pathway between two other streets, and to look for a little black door that will take them into the house. And they can't find it. And they search and search, and then suddenly it appears. And they think, well, that's strange, but we must have just missed it. So we know that Slade House is in a city. I don't know that which city it is. I don't remember. But when they emerge from the door, then they're in this beautiful garden, and it just doesn't seem possible with the space involved that they could be in a city. So as soon as they get there, then Nathan and his mother meet the woman who had invited them to the house, who is named Lady Nora Grayer. And she takes the mom and goes into the house, and Nathan meets a boy in the garden, and he just sort of appears, and they hang out together. And So Nathan and his mother are immediately separated, and then kind of strange things start happening. And I don't want to tell you anything what happens, but it's just kind of a sort of trippy. The next story follows the same basic plot. It's an outsider that's visiting Slade House, and they meet the occupants, and they don't stay the same from chapter to chapter. They change personalities, and then weird things happen. So that's what you'll get from this book. Even though it's a haunted house book, sometimes I think those can be kind of lightly written, and the stories are really short. They're still really great characters, and you find out, you know, all this information about their backstory, and you know all of these things that you just can tell sort of what these people are with really limited information, and that's because the author is a really good writer. So I haven't read all of the other books that David Mitchell has written, but I guess some of these characters play into his other books, just in minor ways. Yeah. But I don't know what those are, but that's what I've heard. And the last story ends on October 31st, 2015. Oh. And I wish I had been reading it that night, but I was at a haunted house myself. So I did not read it. But it sounds like it just pulls together in a really cool way. So I'm excited to finish it. And so far, I really enjoy it. It's really great.
David Mitchell always has uniquely structured
right.
books. That's part of the story is revealed by the structure of the book. I think I've only read one of his, Cloud Atlas, mm-hmm. But that was part of it. The part of the discovery of the story was because of the structure of the book, which is interesting.
And it's cool because you read the first one and you think, okay, that was a creepy story. Yeah. And as you go through, you start to see these little really small details that run through the story, and you know that they're going to build up into something. So he's just really, really smart at what he does.
And I'm reading The Art of Crash Landing by Melissa DiCarlo. I've been on this chick lit kick. I feel like every week I'm talking about the book that I'm reading is chick lit. This is another chick lit, although this is a mystery and chick lit. It is about Maddie Wallace, who is 30 and pregnant, recently found out she's pregnant. She just broke up with her boyfriend. She has no job. She has nowhere to live.
Oh, gosh.
So she's kind of down on her luck. And she hears that her grandmother has passed away and left her an inheritance. And she decides to go to her mother's birthplace, which is Gandy, Oklahoma, small town in Oklahoma. And her mother was a single mom and an alcoholic and never really talked about where she grew up or why she left her hometown. And so Maddie didn't have any relationship with her grandmother either. So this is all a surprise to her that this town exists or that her grandmother left her an inheritance. So she gets to this town and her grandmother has left her a house basically, but it's going to take 6 months of probate court to figure out, you know, the assets and everything. So she knows she's kind of, and her car breaks down. So she's kind of going to be stuck in the small town for a while. And while she's there, she starts asking around about her mom to get more information about what she was like as a child and why she left, because she left the town 35 years ago and Maddie is 30. So she knows that it's not because she got pregnant with Maddie and left because of that. So she's trying to put the pieces together, and she starts hearing all these stories about her mom that paint her mother as a very cheerful, bright, young teenager with this great future in front of her. And that is not at all the woman that Maddie knew. She knew her as down on her luck kind of a person, like I said, an alcoholic, single mom. So it doesn't really fit to her that she had this one path, but then ended up in a different one. So she's trying to piece it all together. And like I said, it's a small town. So you get lots of your quirky, eccentric characters that you get in a small town, which I love. Maddie works in a library, which is great. We love library books. And there's a little bit of romance, but there's also the mystery. And it's just a fun read. I'm only maybe about halfway through, so I'm not exactly sure where it's going quite yet or where it will end up, but it's fun. I've really enjoyed it so far. And I think this is Melissa DiCarlo's first novel It just came out a few weeks ago in October, I think. So that's The Art of Crash Landing by Melissa DiCarlo. All right. Should we go back over the list of what we read this week?
Yes. So my first book was Angle Over Pose by Wallace Stegner, The Beekeeper's Apprentice by Laurie R. King, Yaki Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass by Meg Medina, and what I'm reading this week is Slate House by David Mitchell.
And I talked about The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert, Shadow Divers by Robert Kersen, Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, and what I'm reading this week is The Art of Crash Landing by Melissa DiCarlo. If you lead a book club and have other book club suggestions, we would love to hear what you're reading in your book club and how they've gone over. Or if you try one of these in your book club, let us know how they go over. And if you want to get in touch with us to tell us about that or give us any feedback about the show or a suggestion on a topic you'd like us to discuss, you can email us at wellreadpod@gmail.com or on Twitter at wellreadpodcast. Please rate and review us on iTunes or your other podcast provider of choice. Our podcast is engineered by Adam Farver. Our theme music is Kitten by Poddington Bear. We keep our show notes at beaufortcountylibrary.org/wellread, where you can find a listing of every book we talked about in this episode. If you'd like a book recommendation list tailored specifically for you, please go to beaufortcountylibrary.org/mynextbook and take a brief survey on what type of books you like. You will need a BCL library card in order to use that service. Thank you all for listening, and happy reading!